Welcome to Friday, Explorers Club. We are embarking on a dinosaur expedition here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You know what blows my mind? Dinosaurs still live among us. The birds outside our window, they're descendants of dinosaurs. We're going to get to the bottom of that. We're going to go on a fossil hunt with Emily Grassley. She's worked with Eileen Grogan, who is digging for fossil fish in Montana.
That's mineralization there. Not even algae.
That.
Ah, good eye. That's part of his shell.
Oh, fun.
From an invertebrate. There you go. There's your first fossil from the Bear Gulch.
Whoa, fossils. What dinosaur questions are on your mind? What do you want to ask about animals that roamed our planet millions of years ago? Here's a number. Grown-ups, you too. Lend a hand. It's 800-642-1234. Emily Grassley is executive producer, host, and writer of the PBS show Prehistoric Road Trip. And on the show, she visits 5 states and 40 paleontology sites. And that is some road trip. Emily, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Wow, I can't think how you would keep 40 sites straight in your head. What is it like spending a whole summer, you know, going from one dig to the next?
It was a feat of coordination is what it was. There was lots of spreadsheets and calendars involved. It was a challenge. You know, we filmed this 3-part series over about 8 weeks over the course of last summer. And, you know, we had 3 different filming trips within that to give our crew a break, sort of giving them a week in between. But once we hit the road, you know, we would drive from one site to the next, often across state lines. And we never really knew where we were going to, you know, be the next day, what adventures we would find when we got there, just based on the itinerary that we had mapped out. So it was exciting.
And so this was the Great Plains, and you're actually from the Northern Great Plains. And I want to get a visual here because the Great Plains is the name of a high plateau of grasslands that is in our country. Can you tell us where this is?
Yeah, so we're talking about the places that we filmed specifically were Western South Dakota, North Dakota, Eastern Montana, Central Eastern Wyoming, and one tiny corner of Nebraska. So if you look at a map of the United States, you've got the East Coast, you've got the West Coast, you've got what we call the Midwest, which in my opinion is really just sort of like Central East Coast. And then west of that, you begin to get the plains. And then the Northern Great Plains is part of this northern corridor of Great Plains area that is through sort of the central part of the country, all the way from Texas, Kansas, Nebraska to North Dakota into Canada. So this is the pathway of many ancient glaciers and the former area of the Western Interior Seaway, sort of in the middle of the United States, and in this Northern Great Plains area, which is east of the Rocky Mountains, is where we were filming. Yeah.
Which is where you grew up in this area. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm from the Black Hills of South Dakota. So I spent a lot of time roaming around the plains and mountains of that area.
When did you start to love fossils?
Oh, there's a picture of me on my 3rd birthday unwrapping a T-Rex toy from the Jurassic Park series, and I am stoked. I have such like a jazzed dino face on. So I grew up surrounded by the idea of dinosaurs. Sue, the T-Rex, the most complete Tyrannosaurus Rex skeleton ever found, was found on my dad's neighbor's ranch outside of Faith, South Dakota. So growing up, I watched the news stories. I followed the tale of this amazing fossil find, leaving South Dakota, finding its way to Chicago at the Field Museum.
Sue lives at the Field Museum now, on display there?
Yeah, right.
But Sue was actually your neighbor in a way.
Yeah, Sue was my neighbor. So yeah, I've worked at the Field Museum in Chicago for the last 7 years. And even before I came out to Chicago, I knew about this amazing dinosaur and I felt this strong connection to it. And My grandfather was still alive when I was hired at the museum, and he was really the super dino nerd of the family. I studied art in college, and I painted a portrait of him sitting with Sue the T-Rex. So this was like years before I worked at the museum. And when I got hired at the museum, I told my grandpa they brought me on to make sure that somebody would always from South Dakota would always be taking a look after Sue for him.
Sue's keeper. We're talking with Emily Grassley, executive producer, host, and writer of the PBS show Prehistoric Road Trip. We're taking your questions. Have you watched Prehistoric Road Trip on PBS? What was your favorite part? What would you like to ask Emily about digs, about dinosaurs? The number is 800-642-1234. So, Emily, what is the story of Sue the T-Rex? What was life like for Sue? Can we learn that through Sue's fossils?
Oh, absolutely. And even more from just looking at Sue's fossils, we can look at all the fossils that were found with Sue. So we know from studying Sue's remains and from studying the other rocks and sediments and fossils that were collected with Sue, that Sue was alive at the very end of what we call the Mesozoic period. So the Mesozoic period includes the Triassic period, the Jurassic period, and the Cretaceous period. And those are sort of the three iconic ages of the dinosaurs. And T-Rex, which the tyrant lizard king is what Tyrannosaurus Rex means, was alive right at the end of the Mesozoic period before this fateful asteroid came and collided with the Yucatan of Mexico 66 million years ago and wiped out most all dinosaurs, except for the ones that went on to become birds, as you mentioned at the top of the program. But there's so many things that we've learned by studying Sue's skeleton. You know, we know, for instance, things like how big the dinosaur got.
How big did Sue get?
Sue is, I believe, 13, no, it's like, I think 42 feet from tip to tail. I can't exactly remember. That's a great question. It's too early for math this morning. So large dinosaur.
Very large dinosaur. Very strong, strong bite, strong teeth, I would imagine.
Yes, huge bite force. Some of Sue's teeth are, we call them like banana daggers. They're the size and shape of bananas. They're absolutely massive. But there's so much else that we've learned from like the, you know, fossil clams that are found alongside T-Rex or the other fragments of bones from turtles and crocodiles. You begin to understand that this was kind of a swampy environment. This was a wet area. The climate was very different. It would have been quite a bit warmer too. It doesn't look at much like what South Dakota looks like there today.
Yeah. You can kind of piece together Sue's life and Sue's environment. When they were doing all these excavations, were you at all watching them as a kid or just kind of reading about it in newspapers? And what was that like?
Well, I never really got to participate in one as a kid. Followed along newspapers. In fact, you know, South Dakota is amazing. And this is why we wanted to make a whole series just kind of focusing on this region, because you can find fossil deposits, not just from the age of when Sue was living, but from many different geologic ages. So I remember really fondly as a kid going on a ride through Badlands National Park with my mom. And we were on this road through the park, and we stopped because there was this group of graduate students on the side of the road that had a tent set up and they were excavating something. And we stopped and we asked them what they were looking for, and they said that they called this the Big Pig Dig. And we were like, what is the Big Pig Dig? And what they were finding were what are called entelodonts, or sometimes called hell pigs.
Oh, save those hell pigs. Don't go anywhere. Emily Grassley with us, hosts the Natural History series. We'll be back with her in a moment on the Ideas Network. Well, this is the coolest Friday on the planet because we're talking about dinosaurs. Thanks for joining us, explorers. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our trusty guide is Emily Grassley. She met a paleontologist in North Dakota by the name of Clint Boyd, and here he is showing Emily a layer of clay that reveals the Cretaceous Paleogene extinction event. Whoa, try to say that fast. Let's call it the day an asteroid impact wiped out the dinosaurs.
If you spread your hand out, you know, you can put your thumb below that boundary, and then up where your pointer finger is at, there's no more dinosaurs.
Wow.
So dinosaurs to no dinosaurs right across that little spot.
Dinos? Asteroid impact, really bad day, no dinos.
Whoa, there you have it. You can join in with your dino questions, 800-642-1234. And Emily Grassley from Prehistoric Road Trip stays with us. Well, Emily, let's take a call now. Evelyn is joining us from Hammond. Hi, Evelyn.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind about dinosaurs?
I'd like to know how they came to be.
Ooh, how did dinosaurs come to be?
Oh, that's a really good question. That's a really hard question to answer. And there are lots of scientists today that are still trying to figure this out. But dinosaurs came to be a really, really long time ago at the beginning of the Triassic period. And we find their fossils in places like Africa, there are different places in Tanzania and Kenya where early dinosaur fossils are found. But, you know, they evolved a really long time ago. And the first dinosaurs actually kind of look like crocodiles, but if crocodiles could run like a dog. And so you had these kind of scrappy animals that looked very different than anything alive today. And the first dinosaurs went on to, you know, turn into everything from the largest terrestrial animal to ever walk the earth, like the big brontosaurs or the big sauropods, you know, the long-necked dinosaurs, everything from them to T-Rex over a period of about 140 million years. And even today, you know, we mentioned birds are dinosaurs, and those are the living descendants of some of the dinosaurs that were still living at the end of the Cretaceous.
Evelyn, do you have a favorite dinosaur?
Yep, Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Good pick, Evelyn.
Mm-hmm.
What do you like about T-Rex?
Because he's so scary.
That's true.
You know, I wonder, Emily, did dinosaurs scare each other just by their size and the features on their body?
I'm sure they probably did. You know, I think if you were a Triceratops living at the same time as T-Rex, you would probably spend a great amount of your time trying to avoid them because they were, you know, the largest predator that ever walked the earth. And they could run really fast. T-Rex had a great sense of smell. And there's even some researchers who believe that T-Rex, they traveled or hunted in packs, like hyenas. So that's a pretty terrifying mental image.
Oh, like a stampede. Wouldn't that be scary? What about the dinosaurs that could fly? Can you tell us about those?
Yeah, so we know from dinosaurs that are or fossils preserved in amber, you know, we've been able to look at how feathers evolved over long periods of time too. And so the first flying dinosaurs, you know, they might have had teeth like we don't see birds having today. They probably had talons and claws to help them climb up trees. They might have even had claws on their wings to help them climbing up trees. And so that's kind of how we see the evolution of flight progress, because you got to start from somewhere, right? If you look at a baby bird, learning how to fly, they're pretty awkward. Well, that probably went on for a couple, you know, million years, before they were able to fully grow their wings.
Can you take us to the KT boundary and what that is?
Yeah. So the KT boundary or the KPG boundary, is a geologic signature that you can find in rocks of that age. We're looking at about 66 million year old rock formations. And this is a physical geologic signature that geologists refer to as kind of the day the dinosaurs died. And what's unique about the KTPG boundary is that It's a geologic layer that is full of an element called iridium. And iridium is a common element found in space rocks like asteroids, meteorites, that kind of thing, but isn't very common found on the surface of the Earth. And so it was a couple of researchers back in the 80s were in Italy, I think was one of the first places that they found this boundary line with a lot of iridium. And these researchers were wondering what would have caused this? What would have deposited all this iridium from everywhere from North Dakota to Italy? You know, it's covering the entire Earth. And it was one of the big clues that led researchers to realize that it was linked with an asteroid impact. And then the next thing they had to go find was evidence of the impact itself. And that's when researchers found this gigantic crater in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, which was the appropriate age, size, diameter, and had rocks that you could trace all the way from that part of Mexico all the way up into North America and into the United States, where this asteroid would have hit the Yucatan Peninsula and then sprayed rocks from that area all over as far as they could reach for hundreds and hundreds of miles. It was a pretty big impact.
So scientists are feeling pretty confident about this theory that it is an asteroid that wiped out the dinosaurs.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are other researchers and paleontologists who are looking at different aspects of the environment, too. Because there is a question, well, did the asteroid impact, is that 100% responsible for wiping out the dinosaurs? Or maybe the dinosaurs, maybe they were already kind of on the decline. There's some researchers who are studying huge supervolcano events in places like India. So there's a time where India just was like erupting with volcanoes for like hundreds of thousands of years for a really long time. And so maybe all of those volcanic eruptions contributed to it. So we're learning new things about the extinction event of the dinosaurs all the time.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Emily Grassley. She is chief curiosity correspondent at the Field Museum in Chicago and hosts the PBS series Prehistoric Road Trip. You can join in. What is your favorite dinosaur or dinosaur fact? What do you like about dinosaurs? What's the coolest fossil you've ever seen or learned about? We're at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Sam now, who joins us from Madison. Hi, Sam. Oh, and Sam is not there, actually. Well, Emily, I want to ask you about in Nebraska, the Agate Fossil Beds National Monument, and you found these long vertical spiral towers embedded in the rock. What mm-hmm. are those?
Yeah, so there in this place in Nebraska, if you're walking across the prairie, sometimes you see an exposed bluff where there's been some erosion and a column of rock is exposed. And within the column of rock, a long time ago, early settlers to the area and indigenous people who were living there had noticed these spiral columns. And what I think is really interesting about them is for a long time, researchers didn't quite know what they were. They're very unusual. They're kind of symmetrical in a way, like they look like they were created by something. But the settlers couldn't figure out what they were. And so they called them the Devil's Corkscrew. And it wasn't until a graduate student was studying them and had a rock hammer and dropped the rock hammer on one of these spirals, it cracked open and they found the fossil remains of an ancient land beaver that had been living inside of the burrow, which led these researchers to realize that these burrows were caused by animals that behaved a little bit like how prairie dogs behave today, you know, ground squirrels that create these networks of underground caves and systems. And that's what these land beavers were doing before beavers lived in the water. You know, this was a different kind of beaver.
It's kind of like saying, hi, guys, we haven't evolved that much. I mean, do you need more clues?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
You have also looked at microfossils and what scientists are learning about extinction from studying microfossils. Those must be extremely small.
They are. They're so small you need a microscope to look at them. So you asked me earlier, you know, what can we learn about T-Rex or the environment that they lived in? Well, we actually learned more things from studying like the tiny microfossils found alongside some of those bigger, more charismatic fossils. So the microfossils that researchers study from these kind of deposits are things like teeth. Teeth, as we talk about in the program, they're the hardest part of the body. They preserve really well. And you can learn a lot from looking at a tooth, even the teeth in your own mouth. You know, all of the teeth in your mouth are a different shape. They all serve a different purpose in terms of chewing, the kind of food that they're good for, breaking down. And the same can be said about other mammals and other animals for hundreds of thousands of years.
We love our dinosaurs, and Emily Grassley is helping us appreciate fossil remains, unlock dinosaur mysteries this hour. Have you searched for fossils? Did you find any? Do you want to be a paleontologist or a scientist one day? By the way, if we haven't asked you yet, what is your favorite dinosaur? Here's that number again. It's 800-642-1234. Don't go anywhere, especially near an asteroid. We're going to continue our journey through our prehistoric past right after this dinosaur-free news update, Boo, on the Ideas Network. Hi again. We're back, Explorer friends. We're learning about when dinosaurs roamed the Earth and when it all went poof. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. I'm so glad you're here. Emily Grassley has been on lots of dinosaur fossil hunts as the host of the show Prehistoric Road Trip, and she is guiding us this hour. So many great questions now. Let's go right to Keith, who is joining us from Beloit. Hi, Keith.
Hello. Pleased to meet you, and it's very interesting so far. I was wondering, though, Roy Chapman Andrews hailed from Beloit, and in his book he credits himself with discovering dinosaur eggs in China in the Gobi Desert, yet I didn't find any evidence of dinosaur eggs at the National Museum, and they claim he was never a director there. So I'm kind of confused. A couple of questions here. Was he a director, and did he discover dinosaur eggs?
No, very specific questions there, Keith. What about those dinosaur eggs?
Yeah, so Roy Chapman Andrews did work at the American Museum of Natural History, and I do believe that he is credited with finding dinosaur eggs. They are likely still at the AM&H. Also, one of the places that we visited, the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman, Montana, they have a great collection of dinosaur eggs as well. I think their research in the 80s and 90s has helped support a lot of Roy Chapman Andrews' early discoveries of nesting sites in China, Mongolia.
What can we learn from dinosaur eggs?
Oh, you can learn amazing things. For one, you can learn, you know, how large they were when they were hatched. You can learn about sort of the makeup of the eggs. You know, we think about eggs, are they like chicken eggs or are they like lizard eggs? And I think they were a little more leathery. They were kind of like sea turtle eggs. And the size question is really important, too, because if you know how large an animal is when it hatches and you know how large it is when it dies, you can do the kind of work that they do at the Museum of the Rockies, which is called paleohistology, where essentially they look at the inside of these dinosaur bones. And by looking at the cellular structure that's still preserved within the fossil bones, they can get an idea of how quickly these animals grew. And that those questions really inform a lot of different things about the animal. Like if we know that a sauropod, like an Apatosaurus, is about the size of a cantaloupe when it's hatched, and 20 years later, it's 120 feet long, well, that gives you a rate of growth. You know, I'm 30 years old and I'm only 5'8". So you kind of learn that, you know, there's a certain cap of how big a human can be. And you can track, you know, how quickly people grow on average. And you can do the same thing with dinosaurs.
Fascinating. Keith, thanks for the question. Let's bring in Jane now in Madison. Hi, Jane.
Hello. My question had to do with, are there birds today that we can kind of imagine how dinosaurs moved when dinosaurs were alive? I was thinking of sometimes when I see turkeys walking on the ground, I wonder that movement of the way the head moves and the body moves. And then I just, while I was waiting, I thought, look, pelicans, the way they look.
Yeah, this is actually one of my favorite studies I've ever seen. the researchers had the same question. Can we learn about dinosaur movement by studying living birds today? And we can. And one of the ways that that these researchers tracked the gait of an animal is that they attached a plunger, a toilet plunger, to the butt of a chicken. And you can, if you Google chicken plunger dinosaur walk, you can find YouTube videos of this chicken with a plunger on its butt. And the reason that they put the plunger there is they wanted to simulate the kind of tail that a T-Rex would have. And so you can watch this chicken walking, and it stalks like you could imagine a T-Rex would walk. It's really fascinating.
Oh, wow. And so they were trying to put a feature on the chicken so that it would more closely resemble what the dinosaur looked like, to see what it might, how it might walk.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know, if you've got something hanging off your back end, that's going to create, it's going to create a counterbalance, and it's going to change the way that you walk and move forward. And so that's what they were interested in studying. And the way they achieved that is by putting a plunger on a chicken.
Isn't it amazing, though, that in the movies we watch about dinosaurs, we really interpret how dinosaurs move based on what we see on a big screen?
Yeah, or just, you know, a lot of those researchers, when they're making those artistic decisions for movies, they go to zoos. They observe a lot of animals. If you look at an animal like an ostrich or an emu, they look really prehistoric. You look at the, you know, shape and the scaly features of their legs and their feet, and you can start to imagine, you know, the different features of what an animal like a T-Rex might have looked like.
Jane, thanks for the question. Let's go to Sue now in Jefferson with a question. Hi, Sue.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. My husband and I live rurally on a farm, and I've had the great pleasure of seeing, I'm sure it's just one, but an osprey in flight. And I was wondering, they're so large, if they have prehistoric history.
Well, yeah, I mean, ospreys are lumped in, you know, with the other birds. As when we think about the living descendants of dinosaurs, they certainly fit into that category. But, you know, I don't know the evolutionary history of ospreys in particular. But it is pretty amazing once you start to look at the birds around us in the world today, and you can see that link between them and dinosaurs.
And we're talking with Emily Grassley, creator of the educational series, the PBS series, and she visited five states, 40 paleontology sites in the northern Great Plains. We're learning about dinosaurs this hour. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Emily, what was that like for you to be alongside paleontologists all day digging for fossils? What are they like? What do they talk about as they're digging? You know, what's that like to be on the ground?
Oh, I had a wonderful time with all of our filming partners. I think one of the things that I love the most about it is that it's such a collaborative team building event. You know, we were out with the Royal Ontario Museum from Canada in the northern part of Montana, where we were assisting them with a dig to find a Triceratops skull. And Triceratops were huge animals, absolutely massive, you know, the size of SUVs. And that requires a lot of help to get everybody in there in this quarry and removing all of the overburden. And so you create these workflows where, you know, kind of you rely on everybody pitching in. And it's just we had such a sense of community and collaboration. I really thought that was unique about this kind of field work. Where everyone was in a small enough space that they could sit for long periods of time, for hours, sharing ideas, picking away, you know, the matrix of rock around from the skull of this animal, and then gradually together revealing the face of a creature that hasn't been seen for 66 million years. It's amazing.
I would imagine you have to be so careful and detail oriented. How do you do this work and not damage these ancient fossils?
Well, that can be hard, especially when you don't know exactly where everything is. You know, through an excavation, you're going to be moving a lot of rock away. You might accidentally, you know, hit a fossil with your hammer. But that's why they invented glue. You know, we came across that time and again, especially with really fragile fossils like the two-dimensional ones we found in the Bear Gulch of Montana. These are ancient fish fossils. They're really flat like pancakes. And they're so fragile, it's really easy. You could just bust one in half if you're not careful. But the researcher we with, Eileen Grogan, she told us, you know, this is why they have glue. We can put it back together. We can still learn useful things from it.
Let's bring in another call now. Kathleen is with us from Madison. Hi, Kathleen.
Well, good morning. Emily, thank you for taking this call, and I've been watching the show intensively. 20 years ago, to reward my then 10-year-old for such good science grades, I found a dig that would allow me and him to come and work on a dig. I always say it was the hardest work I ever paid somebody to make me do. And we were on a dig in the Hell Creek Formation outside of Jordan, Montana. Mm-hmm. Very isolated, very desolate. And what I never quite learned the politics of the exclusivity of sites, how a given university or college gets licensure or access for their grad students. And I also, conversely, infer from your show that this having civilians pay to be allowed to do the grunt work has become more common. Can you tell me some stuff about how dig sites are allocated and whether my inference is correct?
Yeah, it's an interesting observation. So, you know, this really comes down to a lot of technical understanding of land ownership and management in the United States. We have a real patchwork of assortment. You've got public lands that are managed by federal agencies like the Bureau of Land Management, and you've got national parks, you've got private ranches, you've got state parks. All of these different land management areas require a different set of permits, permissions, and essentially relationship building with the land managers. And so, you know, we filmed on a variety of different kinds of lands throughout the show, and managing those permissions was a big part of what we did.
We're talking about dinosaurs. Emily Grassley is here, and she's the host of the PBS show Prehistoric Road Trip. You can join in. Still time for you. 800-642-1234. We'll be back faster than grown-ups can spell Tyrannosaurus Rex right here on the Ideas Network. So awesome to be talking about dinosaurs here in the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Emily Grassley is our guide. She hosts PBS's Prehistoric Road Trip. She knows a lot of people in the paleontology world. And she spoke with Jim Mead, director of research of the Mammoth Site, about its discovery.
They ask us, could we come and take a look? Are these mammoths? What are these things? So we showed up, and it was kind of like, yeah, they're mammoth. You might have two or three, maybe five.
Yeah.
And so we start excavating, and we take out a bone. There's another one below it. Take out another one. There's another one below it. And we go, at some point, we got to stop.
Whoa, have you seen the Mammoth Site? Call in 800-642-1234, and Emily Grassley stays with us. So, Emily, what does the Mammoth Site look like today?
Oh, the Mammoth Site is fascinating. So as Jim had mentioned, you know, there's a housing development that was being constructed in Hot Springs, South Dakota, and the heavy machinery operator was removing some of the overburden and found this mammoth tusk or mammoth bones, and called in these paleontologists, and they thought that they were just going to work there for a summer or so. And two summers later, they couldn't stop finding new mammoth bones. And so eventually they built a physical museum structure over this excavation site. And they're still digging it out today. That was 35 years ago.
Oh, my goodness. How many have they accumulated so far?
They've found, I think, over 120 tusks. And so if you imagine each animal has two tusks, it's about 60 individuals or more of mammoths and mastodons.
Wow. And so they were just roaming around. What were they doing?
They were living their best life. They were eating shrubs and tubers in the Black Hills of South Dakota 100,000 years ago. And eventually they came across a seemingly placid body of water. They thought, wow, this looks really nice. I'm just going to go in for a quick drink and a swim. And then they walked into this lake area that was a huge well with really steep, slick sides. And once they walked into it, they couldn't get out. Mm. So unfortunately, over tens of thousands of years, many, many mammoths made the same mistake and ended up dying and getting, sinking to the bottom, getting buried and becoming fossilized.
Wow. You also, Emily, visited the Standing Rock Sioux tribe. What are they doing to preserve fossils on their land?
Yeah, so the Standing Rock Institute of Natural History, unfortunately, is closed at this point, closed shortly after we were filming out there. But they're still, as a tribe, really interested in preserving the natural heritage of their land. And part of those natural resources include fossils. And so they still have a fossil manager who is working to identify all the different fossil localities within the Standing Rock tribe, protect those fossils, remove them when possible, and put them in a secure collection space. And a lot of these fossils, mostly from Hell Creek Formation, so we're looking at the end of the Cretaceous period, they're important to the cultural identity of the people who live there still today. And so it was fascinating to be invited to go with them and learn more about the paleontology in their tribal lands.
As we were talking about earlier, and researchers getting access to land and access to sites, how are paleontologists working with the tribes in the Northern Great Plains to restore and acknowledge the ancient remains that have been taken from tribal lands?
Well, I wish that more progress was made in this front, but I think unfortunately we're still in the early days of academic sciences like paleontology really acknowledging and recognizing the ways in which indigenous people, indigenous knowledge, how that's been left out of the field of paleontology. When you think about it, people have been living in North America for tens of thousands of years. It's 100% likely and possible and that they came across fossils. And in fact, we know a lot of different stories. There's a scholar, Adrienne Mayer, wrote a book called Fossil Legends of the First Americans, where she's compiled a lot of these oral histories of the interpretations that different indigenous communities around the United States today have, their interpretations of the fossils they have found on their land. And I think there's still just a lot of healing that needs to take place between Western science and indigenous people in the United States because of just a long, terrible history of land theft, resource theft. And we're still, as museum communities and as paleontologists, still reconciling with the ways in which these sciences haven't treated people fairly.
We're talking with Emily Grassley, who is executive producer, host, and writer of the PBS show Prehistoric Road Trip. And you can still join in. There's still time, 800-642-1234. Emily, in the final episode, you traveled to Wyoming to learn about a climate change event. What happened?
We were out with a group from the La Brea Tar Pits and the University of Wyoming and the U.S. Geological Survey. These paleobotanists, they study fossil plants, and they're studying fossil plants from a time called the Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum, or PETM. It's a really long name.
Paleocene-Eocene Thermal Maximum. So we can just say
yes.
PETM.
Yeah, the PETM.
Okay.
And this is an event that you can find in the fossil record that represents a period of time when there was a huge spike of greenhouse gases in the environment caused by, they believe, seafloor volcanic eruptions. So there was a lot of rifting of the seafloor, tectonic plate movement, which released a lot of underwater volcanic explosions that released a bunch of methane and other carbon dioxide, other greenhouse gases. And over a period of about 10,000 years, this completely changed the atmospheric composition and the climate of our world. And the reason why researchers today are so interested in studying the cause of the PETM, as well as the impact and the and sort of the result of the PETM, is because it's the best analogy we have for understanding today's human-caused climate change. So during the PETM, there was a huge amount of, like I said, greenhouse gases emitted, and we're releasing the same amount of greenhouse gases, but at 100 times the same rate, so 100 times faster than was emitted during the PETM. And so there's a real sense of urgency to try and understand, like, how do systems, how do environments, how do organisms respond to these rapid changes in their environment? And can we respond as quickly too?
Well, we have time for one more call. Nick is with us from Antioch, Illinois. Hi, Nick.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I'm an environmental geologist, and but I really love paleontology, and I was lucky enough to visit the Black Hills Institute in 2016 and meet Pete Larson. And I was just wondering what Ms. Grassley's opinion was of sort of the role of amateurs, you know, non-degreed sometimes in paleontology research and acquisition of fossils, because we all know, you know, there was quite an uproar when Sue was sort of taken away from them. So I was wondering what her opinion of that, the amateurs in, are.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I think what you're really asking about is the role of commercial paleontology within academic paleontology. The Larson brothers are, you know, they do some academic work on fossils, but they really, that's part of their bread and butter. Their business is acquiring and selling fossils. And that's a really, it's really complex, the relationship between commercial paleontology. There are some academic societies like the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, which won't allow for their scientists to publish on fossils, vertebrate fossils that are privately owned, because the science can't be replicated. So, I think there are some good examples of collaboration between commercial and non-commercial paleontologists, and I think there are some times where it doesn't work out in as many people's favor. But we're still learning a lot about how best to find this material and how best to work together.
Emily, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Emily Grassley is executive producer and host of the PBS show Prehistoric Road Trip. And by the way, check out our entire series with great interviews with authors and musicians. You may really enjoy getting to know. They're all in one special place. Go to WPR.org/kids. Just ahead, it is On Point. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It is Explorers Club on The Morning Show. And hey, T-Rex, take a bite out of the Ideas Network.